Welcome back to the Deep Dive. I want to start today by asking you a question that, you know, usually just functions as polite filler. But I promise, today, it is actually the entire point of the conversation. So how are you doing?
Well, I am functioning.
You are functioning. Okay. That sounds like you are barely hanging on over there. Usually I get an I'm good or an I'm great. Functioning feels a little grim.
It does sound a bit mechanical, doesn't it? But if I were answering in the true spirit of our subject today, saying, I am functioning, would actually be the highest compliment I could pay myself.
Right. Okay. I see where we're going with this. We are tackling a giant today. So we are doing a deep dive into Aristotle's ethics. Specifically, we're looking at a fascinating lecture series by Dr. Arthur Holmes. And I take it this whole functioning bit is the key to unlocking his philosophy.
It is the master key, really. Dr. Holmes opens his discussion by pointing out that for Aristotle, the very definition of good is entirely dependent on purpose. So whether we are talking about a knife, a horse, or a human being, good simply means proper functioning.
So if I say I'm good, Aristotle doesn't hear I'm happy or I'm a nice person. He just hears I am fulfilling my specific design specs.
Precisely. And this is the concept of teleology. It comes from the Greek word telos, meaning an end, a goal, or a purpose. It's essentially the backbone of Aristotle's entire worldview. He believes that everything in nature, from a rock to a star to a person, has a built-in purpose. So you can't really talk about ethics, about right and wrong, until you answer a much more fundamental question. What is a human being actually for?
Which is the kind of question that usually induces a mild existential crisis at 3 a.m. I mean, it feels huge.
It is huge. But Aristotle is very systematic about it. He doesn't just guess. To find our purpose, he looks at what makes us unique. And Dr. Holmes walks us through Aristotle's hierarchy of the soul. Now, we need a quick disclaimer here for you listening. When Aristotle says soul, don't think ghosts or theology. Think animating principle, what makes a thing alive.
Right, it's biology. It's not just spirituality. And Holmes breaks this down into three tiers, right? At the bottom, you have the vegetative soul.
Which we share with plants. This is nutritive functioning. It's growth, physical health, reproduction. If you are just eating, sleeping, and growing, you are functioning, but only at the level of a fern.
Ouch. I know some weekends where I definitely operate at the fern level.
I think we all do. But moving up a level, you have the animal soul. This covers sensation, appetites, desires, and locomotion. Animals have this, and we have this. It's the part of us that wants food, sex, comfort, and, you know, reacts to pain.
But neither of those makes us distinctly human. Like, if I'm just healthy and chasing snacks, I'm just a really successful golden retriever.
Exactly. And this is the crux of his argument. If your life is just about being healthy, that's the vegetative and chasing pleasure, that's the animal, you aren't fulfilling the human function. The peak, the distinguishing factor that separates humanity from everything else, is the rational soul.
The ability to think, to reason.
Yes. So here is the first major insight from Holmes's lecture. If ethics is about proper functioning and our unique function is reason, then the good for a human being is a complete life lived in accordance with reason.
This totally changes the definition of virtue, though. I think most of us hear the word virtue and think of a list of rules. Don't steal, don't lie, don't run with scissors. But Holmes points out the Greek word is arete.
Yes, aretate. It is often translated as virtue, but a much better translation is excellence.
Excellence. That feels a lot more active.
It is. You can have an arete knife, a knife that cuts perfectly because that is its job. You can have an arete horse that is fast and strong. And a virtuous person is someone who possesses human excellence. They are functioning at the peak of their potential.
But I have to play devil's advocate here. Is this just about outward performance? Like, if I act smart and do the right things, am I virtuous, even if I secretly hate doing it, even if I'm gritting my teeth the whole time?
That is a crucial distinction. Holmes emphasizes that for Aristotle, virtue involves the whole life. It's not just the outward behavior. It's the inner disposition, your motivation, your intention, your attitude. A virtuous person is inner directed.
Inner directed. Meaning what exactly?
Meaning they aren't just reacting to external stimuli like a pinball bouncing off laws or social pressure. They are acting out of an internal drive toward excellence. They do the right thing because it is who they are, not because they are afraid of getting caught.
Holmes uses a phrase I really like for this, habit of the heart. But this leads to a very practical, almost mechanical problem. If virtue is this high-minded state of excellence,
yeah. How
on earth do we actually get it? Do we just wake up one day, decide to be rational, and boom, we're virtuous?
Wouldn't that be nice? But no, this is where Aristotle gets incredibly practical, almost like a modern behavioral psychologist. He argues that we all have the potential for virtue, but it has to be actualized. And the method for that is habit.
Just repetition.
Repetition guided by reason. Holmes quotes a famous Aristotelian phrase here. One sparrow does not a summer make.
Oh, I've heard that. Seeing one bird doesn't mean winter is over.
Right. And doing one good deed doesn't mean you're a good person, nor does one day of good behavior. It requires repeated choices. You have to deliberate, make a choice, and do it again and again until it settles into your character.
Holmes uses the analogy of driving a car here, which I think everyone can relate to. I remember learning to drive a stick shift. It was a complete nightmare. I wasn't thinking about driving, I was thinking about survival.
It's a perfect example. When you first learn, what is your brain doing?
It's panicking. I'm thinking about the clutch, the gas, the mirror, the road signs, the person honking behind me. It is intense, exhausting deliberation. I am using every ounce of reason just to make my hands and feet do the right thing.
Exactly. You are using your rational mind to force your body to function properly. But what happens after 5 years of driving?
I don't even think about it. I can drink coffee, change the radio, talk to a passenger, and shift gears without a single conscious thought.
It has become a habit. Aristotle says moral virtue works the exact same way. We practice thoughtful action, forcing ourselves to be brave when we are scared or generous when we want to be selfish until it stops being a struggle and becomes second nature. We become the kind of person who acts courageously without having to agonize over it.
But wait, isn't that just conditioning? If I just do it out of habit, am I really choosing it anymore? It sounds a bit robotic, like we are programming ourselves.
That's a fair challenge. But Aristotle would say the choice happened during the formation of the habit. You used your reason to build the reflex. Now, your immediate reaction to a situation, say, seeing someone in danger, is the correct one. You don't have to calculate it. You just act. That is true excellence. The goal is to make being good the path of least resistance for your own soul.
However, Holmes brings up a group of people who struggle with this. The people who know what is right, but just can't bring themselves to do it. He calls it akrasia.
Weakness of will. This is the problem of the undisciplined soul. It's a circular trap. It takes temperance, that is, self-control, to build the habit of temperance. But if you don't have self-control to begin with, how do you even start?
Yeah, it's the classic entry-level job requires 5 years of experience problem, but for ethics.
It really is. And Aristotle's answer is somewhat humbling, especially for those of us who like to think we are entirely self-made. He suggests that people who suffer from weakness of will like children, or adults who haven't developed this inner rule, must be ruled by the reason of others.
So disciplined from the outside.
Yes. You instill habits in children through external discipline until they are rational enough to rule themselves. It's a recognition that we aren't all born with an iron will. We need a community or parents to jumpstart that engine. You basically borrow someone else's reason until your own kicks in.
Okay, so we are building these habits. Habits can be bad, too. I can build a habit of eating donuts every morning or doom scrolling every night. When we are deliberating on these choices, what is the target? What are we actually aiming for?
The target is the mean, the golden mean.
The balance between extremes. Now, I have to stop you because I think people often misinterpret this. I often hear golden mean and think compromise. Just be lukewarm. Don't be too good. Don't be too bad. Just be average.
I'm really glad you brought that up because Holmes is very specific here. The mean is not a mathematical average. It's not about being average. It's a peak of excellence that sits between two cliffs. One cliff is the vice of excess, too much, and the other is the vice of deficiency, too little.
Let's look at the examples Holmes pulls from the text because they really clarify this. Take courage. We usually think of fear as the enemy.
Right. But for Aristotle, fear is data. Courage is the virtue. The deficiency, having too little confidence or too much fear, is cowardice. We all know that. But the excess, having too much confidence and absolutely no fear, is foolhardiness.
Being reckless isn't brave. It's just stupid.
In Aristotelian terms, yes. It is a failure of reason. You should be afraid of things that are actually dangerous. Or take generosity. The virtue is a giving attitude. The deficiency is miserliness or stinginess. But the excess is profligacy, throwing your money away unwisely.
I think that's a trap a lot of nice people fall into. They think being good means giving until they are completely destitute. But Aristotle would say, no, that's an excess. That's not proper functioning.
Exactly. Because you are ruining your ability to function and help others in the future. Holmes points out that hitting the mean requires intellectual virtue, specifically something called phronesis, or practical wisdom. It's about feeling the right thing at the right time toward the right people with the right motive.
So it's highly situational. It's not a rigid rule book where never get angry is a universal rule.
Not at all. Take anger. Is anger bad?
Usually we're told it is.
Aristotle would disagree. He'd say, if you see a terrible injustice, someone hurting a child, for instance, and you feel nothing, that is a deficiency. You should be angry. But if you fly off the handle because the barista got your order wrong, that's excess. The virtuous person gets angry at the right things.
That makes a lot of sense. It's about emotional calibration.
Yeah.
But I have to admit, this sounds like a lot of work. Constant calculation, self-discipline, monitoring your habits. It brings me to a question I think a lot of you listening might have right now. Is this a fun life? Where does pleasure fit in? If I'm constantly calculating the mean, am I allowed to actually enjoy myself?
It's the classic hedonist's question.
Yeah.
And Aristotle addresses this directly. He says, pleasure is not the goal. The goal is eudaimonia, which is often translated as happiness, but really means flourishing or well-being.
So fun is strictly forbidden. Got it.
No, quite the opposite. He views pleasure as a byproduct. It's a fringe benefit of functioning properly.
Oh, Holmes uses the meal analogy here, right?
Yes. Imagine going out for a delicious, expensive dinner. If you spend the entire meal calculating the cost, analyzing the nutrients, or worrying about whether you are enjoying it enough to justify the bill,
you ruin the meal. You're in your head, not in the experience.
Exactly. The pleasure comes from the activity itself. If you focus on the activity, eating, conversing, experiencing, the pleasure naturally ensues.
I really like that. It's like the phrase, happiness ensues. You can't chase it directly.
Mm-hmm.
If you chase pleasure, you usually end up with addiction or emptiness. If you chase excellence, you get pleasure as a bonus.
Precisely. And Holmes adds that Aristotle believes pleasures differ in moral worth. There is a pleasure in a night on the town, and there is a pleasure in solving a complex problem or reading philosophy. Since pleasures vary in quality, pleasure itself can't be the ultimate standard of good. It's just the cherry on top.
Now, up until this point, we've been talking a lot about the individual, my soul, my habits, my balance. But Aristotle didn't think we could do this alone in a vacuum, did he?
Absolutely not. And this is where we zoom out. Holmes emphasizes the Greek term physai by nature. Aristotle argues that humans are social beings by nature.
Meaning we are hardwired for community.
We cannot function properly in isolation. Our purpose is tied to others. Holmes has this wonderful section where he just tears apart the myth of Robinson Crusoe.
Oh, I loved this part. The whole idea of the rugged individualist.
Holmes points out that Daniel Defoe, who wrote Robinson Crusoe, was reflecting an 18th century individualism. The idea that a rational man can be perfectly alone with his goats and his god and still be fully human. Aristotle would say that is complete nonsense.
Because without society, you can't practice the virtues.
Exactly. How can you be generous if there is no one to give to? How can you be just if there is no one to treat fairly? How can you show courage if there is no one to protect? For Aristotle, the state, the community, is just the individual writ large. A just society is one that is rationally ordered for the common good, just like a just individual is rationally ordered for their own good.
And this leads to a really interesting contrast with his teacher, Plato. We've discussed Plato before in the deep dive, and he had this very rigid idea of the perfect republic. Philosopher kings, specific classes, everything set in stone.
Plato was an idealist. He believed the perfect form of the state existed in a transcendent heaven, and we had to copy it. Aristotle is much more of a scientist, more down to earth. He admits that different forms of government can work. He's flexible.
He's not looking for one perfect structure. He's looking for proper functioning within the real world.
Yes. Whether it's a monarchy or a democracy, does it serve the common good? That's the test. He is looking for functionality, not a utopia.
And that grounding in the real world extends to his view on art, which is surprising because usually when you hear rational philosopher, you don't think lover of poetry. But Holmes says Aristotle actually defends art against Plato's criticism.
He does. Remember, Plato was suspicious of art. He thought it was an imitation of an imitation. If the world is a copy of the perfect forms and art copies the world, then art is twice removed from truth. It's a distraction.
But Aristotle flips that entirely.
He argues that art, specifically tragedy and drama, is an imitation of life, of character, and of emotion. And Holmes drops this incredible line. Aristotle considers poetry to be more scientific than history.
That sounds completely backward. History is facts. Poetry is made up. How is the made-up stuff more scientific?
Think about what history is to Aristotle. It's a chronicle of particulars. This happened on Tuesday, then Alcibiades did this on Wednesday. It's just a list of events, tells you what happened to one person.
Okay, I see that.
Poetry, however, captures universals. When you watch a great play like Oedipus Rex or even a modern film, You don't just see one guy having a bad day. You look at the character and say, aren't we all like that? It reveals universal truths about human nature. It helps us see the patterns in human behavior.
So art is a simulation of the human experience. It teaches us about ourselves.
Exactly. And it serves a function for our emotions, too. This is where we get the concept of catharsis.
I've always heard this word, but what does it actually mean in this specific context?
It means a purging or a cleansing. A good tragedy arouses fear and pity, but not just to make us sad. The goal is to flush those emotions out of our system in a controlled setting.
It's emotional hygiene.
That's a great way to put it. By experiencing these intense emotions in a theater, we restore our emotional balance. We leave the play cleansed and ready to return to a life governed by reason. It all ties back to the golden mean, keeping our emotions in the right balance so we can actually function.
It really is an incredibly cohesive system. Biology, habits, politics, art. It's all about hitting that sweet spot of functioning. Before we wrap up, though, there is one charge against Aristotle that Holmes addresses in the outro. The idea that Aristotle is a pragmatist in the style of John Dewey, meaning he just cares about what works.
Holmes is very firm on this. Aristotle is not a pragmatist in that modern sense. Pragmatism often suggests that values are just instruments, tools to get what we want right now. Whatever gets results is true.
But Aristotle thinks virtue is real.
He believes in intrinsic good. Virtue is good in itself, not just because it pays off. You ought to be courageous because courage is part of human excellence, regardless of whether it makes you rich or popular. He's an ethical absolutist when it comes to the virtues.
Even if he doesn't give us a rule book for every specific situation.
Exactly. Yeah. He gives us absolute virtues to embody, but he respects the complexity of life enough to say, you have to use your practical wisdom to apply them. It's not about blind rule following. It's about becoming a certain kind of person.
So let's quickly recap the journey Dr. Holmes took us on. We started with the biological soul and the idea that our purpose is to live in accordance with reason. We learned that we achieve this through habit driving the car until it becomes second nature. We aim for the golden mean, avoiding the extremes of excess and deficiency. We realize we can only do this together in a society. And finally, we use art to cleanse our emotions so we can stay balanced.
It is, as Holmes says, a complete life.
It really is. And I want to leave all of you listening with a thought that struck me while looking at the habit section. If we are what we repeatedly do, and if our habits of the heart are formed by our daily choices,
go on.
It makes you wonder, what habit are you currently installing in yourself right now without even realizing it? Every time you check your phone, every time you cut someone off in traffic, or every time you listen to a deep dive like this, you are training your soul. Is that habit leading you toward an excess, a deficiency, or that golden mean?
That is a very provocative question. We are always training ourselves to be something. We should probably make sure it's something we actually want to be.
Thanks for joining us for this deep dive into Aristotle. Go function properly, everyone.